Hello, my name is Robert J. Rosenthal. I'm the managing editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and you are listening to a podcast from the San Francisco Chronicle.
This is Jane Kay, environment writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Today we're talking to Dennis Hayes, who was the first organizer of Earth Day in 1970. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's a pleasure, Jane.
Now, could you please tell us, how did Earth Day get started, and how did you spread the word around the country?
Well, it got started with an idea by a senator, Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin, who wanted to have, in its first iteration, a campus environmental teach-in. And then he brought in Pete McCloskey, the congressman from Northern California. And so we had a Democratic senator, a Republican congressman. They had an announcement. I was at that point a college student, and I had just gone to Harvard, and I didn't know anybody, and I thought this would be a good chance to meet people if I organized it. So I flew down to Washington and had a meeting with the senator to see if I could get the charter to organize Harvard. It turned out after their announcement, they'd been getting just sacks of mail and from people across the country, and this thing had turned into something that had quite a bit of sizzle to it on the basis of just a press announcement. So our five-minute courtesy call turned into a two-hour strategy session, and I went back with the charter to organize Boston. And then Pete McCloskey called some people at Stanford, where I'd been the previous year, to sort of check on me, and apparently got decent reports, so I was invited to come down and organize the United States. All of this taking place in about 5 days and utterly changing my life. And what we learned was that while there was interest in some college campuses, mostly they were not interested in teach-ins. They were interested in doing something. And most of them wanted to move off of the campus and deal things in the surrounding communities. And then as we reached into the surrounding communities, we found that there were an awful lot, particularly of women, who were, 25 to 40 in single wage earner families, typically college educated with a couple of young kids, who were really turned on by this. And when we finally put a big ad in the New York Times to give it some sizzle, we decided to forget the teach-in concept. We rechristened it Earth Day. We changed the focus from universities to communities, and it just exploded across the country. The way that we got the word out in that pre-internet, pre-World Wide Web era was relatively crude by today's standards. We persuaded magazines that appealed to any interest group that there was an angle on it for them to talk about Earth Day. And in those days in journalism, it was not uncommon to get people, when they were writing an article, particularly a feature article, about something viewed as kind of this youth quake, to include an address, a telephone number. So we would broadcast the fact that we were doing this, and then people would respond to us. We'd get them on their mailing list. We'd put them in an addressograph machine, and we would crank out newsletters to them, let them know what other people were doing, and built a national community.
Are you surprised now how the feeling, not only for Earth Day, but also for sustainability, for environmentally friendly actions have spread through our society?
Let me parse the question. With regard to Earth Day, this is not at all what we expected in 1970. We thought it was going to be a one-time event like the Poor People's March on Washington or the March on the Pentagon. But instead it became this annual affair that in 1990 we took internationally and now celebrated in north of 180 nations every year with well north every year of 100 million participants. It's become the largest secular holiday in the world. That certainly was not what we had in mind when we first put together the first event. With regard to environmentalism, however, and the spread of these values of concern for public health, for protecting natural systems, for maintaining the biological integrity of the planet, I think we knew from the start that we were opening up a brand new, very important movement that had the same kind of enduring relevance forever for mankind as concerns for peace or concerns for human rights. And in fact, there was a little bit of tussle in those days. I don't want to over-exaggerate this, but the fiercest of the anti-war radicals were quite concerned that the environmental movement might cause anti-war sentiment to wane because it would be a conflicting source of potential attention in newspapers and things. And we tried to make clear that, one, we would be talking about all of the environmental aspects of the war in Southeast Asia, including the destruction of fertile ecosystems, the spread of all kinds of carcinogenic compounds that were part of our herbicide campaign, but also that what we were trying to do was to launch something that would be of huge importance over global issues long after that particular war had become basically a footnote to history. We are always having wars. We are always going to be trying to get out of them in a way that is satisfactory. But we were trying to launch a brand new perception of how humans interact with their environment.
I actually remember those controversies, and you were right. You were right, Dennis.
Now, well, I will confess it was painful. I mean, I've been in public meetings where these people who had been sort of friends and colleagues a year previous were accusing me of perhaps being on the payroll of the CIA. I mean, it was Looney Tunes.
Well, you certainly took the long view. Now, you've been traveling around the country as we're approaching Earth Day on April 22nd. What have you been talking about to your audiences, and what kind of questions have you been getting?
The big issue this year, for all kinds of reasons, including the sequential releases of reports by the International Panel on Climate Change, the commercial success of Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, the position that the Bush administration has taken vis-a-vis the global community in his antagonism toward doing anything on climate, has really turfed this up as an issue that's of real interest across the country. So I've been talking a lot about not so much what the problems are, which I think An Inconvenient Truth did a wonderful job on, but what some of the solutions are, how we can get there technically, and with some increasing attention to what are the economic implications of different strategies to get there, some of which would make rather large sums of money available to promote renewable energy and to increase energy efficiency investments across our society and around the world, and others of which have some substantial support on Capitol Hill, would penalize companies like DuPont, which has done a huge amount to clean up its act already, and reward companies that have behaved quite irresponsibly and have built, say, a dozen coal-fired power plants in the last 5 years with no control technologies on them. So the precise details of the solutions are now starting to be, of increasing political interest. I'd also like to say I was in Chico, California, just yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And when one talks about the enduring legacy of Earth Day, Chico was a wonderful example. This is a campus that has a deep commitment to sustainability, trying to work very constructively with the surrounding agricultural regions. They've put together what they think may be the third largest urban-owned, city-owned park in the nation, in Chico. They have, for Earth Month, 60 events, all of them organized by students, some of them deeply educational, and even sort of the ones that you might think of as a little bland, going down and cleaning up a creek bed and having some pizza afterwards. They've got the marketing savvy to call scour and devour, hence making even that cool. It's just really quite wonderful how these seeds we planted 37 years ago have continued to bear such interesting fruit.
If you would tell us just quickly about your work at the Bullitt Foundation, which you founded.
Oh, no, the Bullitt Foundation has been around for more than a half a century.
Is that right?
But it was a very small family foundation that basically, you know, was the typical, I'll give you some money for the opera if you'll give me some money for the Center for Wooden Boats kinds of foundations, until the matriarch of it passed away at the age of 96 in the late 1980s. And the family put the bulk of her estate then into the foundation and decided to try to do something strategic with it as opposed to just back-scratching. And after more than a year of consideration, decided to make it an environmental foundation. And its emphasis is upon trying to build in the Pacific Northwest with a very clear definition of the Pacific Northwest. I should hasten to say for everybody in San Francisco, if you're 1 inch over the California border, we can't touch you. But it's to build a model of sustainable development here. And I'd say, although we cover the waterfront, our principal foci right now are probably energy and water.
Okay. Do you want to give us your web address?
Sure. It's www.bullitt, like the San Francisco Steve McQueen character, bullitt.org.
Oh, Dennis, thank you so much for speaking with us today. This is Jane Kay. I'm environment writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. On Sunday, I'll be having a story on carbon markets, carbon offsets, and what individuals and businesses are doing along those lines. The story will be appearing in the Chronicle as well as on SF Gate. Thank you.